This conversation was recorded as part of the University of Glasgow Spotlight podcast in June 2022. On it, we speak with Mel Sims, Professor of Work and Employment at the University of Glasgow, and we discuss her recent work looking at the concept of social dialogue between worker and employer organisations and the importance of this relationship for skills and training. Welcome to the podcast, Mel.
Thank you.
You've had a long interest in how employers and workers engage with each other. And from this has come the concept of social dialogue. Can you explain for listeners just what you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. It's what used to be called social partnership. And the problem with social partnership as a phrasing is that it kind of assumes that the two sides of the employment relationship are always working together with shared interests. And that's not always the case. There's lots of areas where employers and workers have just fundamentally different interests. So the idea of social dialogue it's a long existing idea. It just hasn't always been called that. Is that process of negotiating and consulting and building consensus, sorting out what can be agreed on in the employment relationship, and then working out how you move forward together. And because that kind of constant state of conflict doesn't make any sense to anybody if you've got to have a long-standing work relationship within your organisation or within a sector or whatever.
And so why is it important then from a business point of view or a economic point of view? And what are the advantages, I guess, when it goes well, but then what happens when it breaks down?
So we talk about different levels of social dialogue. So at company level, organisational level, workplace level, it's often about collective bargaining, but it's through trade unions. But it can also be about negotiation, about what a new uniform policy looks like or whatever. And so it's not always through trade unions at workplace level. Once you get above workplace level, it tends to be through trade unions. But really, it's about making sure that there's a shared understanding of why things need to happen, whether that's a change like a new policy on uniforms or a new car parking policy, which sometimes seem from the outside quite trivial, but are really important to the workers who experience them, through to the really big issues like pay and productivity and work patterns and those kinds of things that affect all of us. They affect how work happens, you know, how well staffed particular organisations are at particular times of the day or the year or whatever it is. But they also help share an understanding with the workforce about why things are like they are. So the more, even if you don't agree on what a pay rise ideally would look like, it helps build an understanding of why the two sides are arguing for different numbers. And that in itself has a process of kind of understanding where the organization is at in terms of profitability or in terms of the particular technological changes they need to make or whatever. So it's that idea that because the employment relationship is ultimately for most of us kind of an open-ended relationship, there has to be a kind of process of negotiating and consulting and building consent in that process. And two sides getting together to work that out is always more effective, even if sometimes that's quite conflictual. And even if sometimes that ends up in a strike, the norm is that there's shared understanding and building collective understanding of the pressures that the sector or the industry or the company is under.
And it's really interesting you're talking about that. I mean, obviously, it's a big issue in a number of different industries at the moment where we're seeing across the UK some really challenging issues going on in different industries and sectors. And in some ways, though, when we think about issues of social dialogue or these social partnerships, a lot of the time we think of it in times of when there's maybe crisis, such as a disagreement. But you've been doing some really interesting work recently looking at, in a more positive, proactive case around skills and training. And maybe could you talk us through what it means in that context and why it's important? Because a really good example of being something where actually this relationship can actually be productive rather than something which is trying to mitigate against a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why skills and training interest me, because it's one of those areas where the common interest of employers the state, you know, the government and workers really do come into alignment. Workers benefit from skills training if it's provided. They benefit potentially from progressing up a career pathway, or even if that's not in an individual company, that might be in a sector or across their lifetime. Employers benefit from higher skilled workers in all sorts of ways. And the state usually benefits partly because higher skilled work tends to be more associated with more satisfied workers, which is, given how many people work across an economy and society, that's usually regarded as a pretty good thing. But normally what happens is people progress in their skills, they also progress in their pay. And so that has kind of financial benefits for the state in terms of tax revenue and those kinds of things, which allows the state to then invest in public services. So it's one of those areas where there's actually a lot of common interest. But when you take it down to the level of the individual company, if you don't provide a mechanism for companies to not compete with each other, there's actually real disincentives for individual companies to train staff. And we've got ourselves in the UK stuck in a bit of this cycle over the last 40, 50 years or so. And so we're stuck in a cycle of low paid, low training jobs. And a huge proportion of our workforce work in those kinds of sectors. That's not to say they don't have any skills, because they often have a lot of soft skills. If they're working in retail, for example, they have a lot of customer satisfaction skills, how to keep happy customers. But they're not skills that the employer has invested in, and they're not skills that the employer will then reward them for by progressing them up a pay scale very much. So we've got ourselves stuck in a little bit of this cycle. And part of the reason is because there are real disincentives if you don't coordinate this at some kind of sector level or national level. There are real disincentives for individual employers to invest in skills training, because if you invest, then it's very likely that your competitors can come along and steal your staff who you've invested in, and then you train the next lot and you risk losing them, and it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle. Now, some employers do decide it's worth investing anyway, but if we look at aggregate and we look at what happens, we know a lot about what happens around skills training from other countries. There's a huge amount of research on what works. And one of the things that we know works is that you have to get employers together to agree what skills they need across the sector, across the labour market for their specific occupations, and what that looks like. And when you do that effectively, it takes that disincentive of training out of the system. So we've been experimenting in the UK and in Scotland slightly differently than in England with various ways of doing that, but we haven't quite got that right yet. There's still a lot of dissatisfaction from employers. And we've mainly focused on apprenticeships, which is part of the answer, but it's not entirely the answer. And so what my work has been doing is been kind of saying, well, what would we need to have in order for those policy levers to work more effectively? And one of the things that we would need is employers to work together to say what they really need in these areas. And that's very difficult in the UK context, because we've had 40, 50 years nearly of policies that have gone in entirely the other direction. We had a bit of a change in the new Labour governments with sector skills councils, but those have largely ebbed away since 2010. And so we've kind of got a system where lots of employers are dissatisfied, but we don't really have a system for kind of bringing them together. And so what my work has been doing is looking at what mechanisms we have already. And we do have some that are trying to do some mechanisms, some organisations, fora that are trying to do this. But what would need to change in that space for this to be to us, for us to really have a sense of how to engage employers when policymakers want to develop better, more effective skills policies? And so that's really what I've been looking at.
And so what are these areas? So what needs to be done? And just a subtext to that is there particular things that need to be done post-pandemic? So obviously we've heard a lot about how skills and training have been turned on their head during the last 2 to 3 years. And are there any new things or things that need to be done more or differently in the post-pandemic world?
So the good news is that in Scotland, more than in England, we do have some industry leadership groups which do try to bring employers together, but they don't cover all of the sectors, industries by a long way, and they don't all have a shared sense of what their objectives are, what their role is. So some of them do talk about skills, and they do try and kind of unify around what that sector needs in terms of skills planning. But they don't cover all sectors. They don't involve, they don't always involve worker organizations, unions, and worker voices. They don't all engage with politicians and policymakers in the same way. Some of them do, some of them don't. It's a bit higgledy-piggledy. So there's a lot of potential for for some sort of structure like that to really bring together, in the spirit of social dialogue, discussions around skills and discussions about what employers want collectively, because employers are often not great at thinking about the strategic needs of the sector or the occupation, for example. And it can be done, but it needs to be deliberate. It needs to be facilitated. It needs to be organized in some way. So it's that organization that we really need to move towards in order to get the real benefits of some of the policies, because there are good policies in this area, but the employer engagement is the block, sometimes the hurdle that where they kind of stumble. And that's quite different from trade unions, because trade unions are weak, much weaker than they were, say, 40 years ago. But they do have structures. They are organized across sectors and occupations. They have structures that allow a democratic decision-making process about what a policy around skills, for example, is. They can speak at occupational level, they can speak at company level, they can speak at national level. So they kind of have these structures. They sometimes have capacity problems in actually delivering that, but they do exist. But on the employer side, it's much more fragmented. So some of the recommendations I've been making are around using what we've got and sort of making sure it covers the all of the sectors of the economy, and then structuring in more formal discussions about skills that include not just the employers and the unions, but also include the state, because of course state money usually pays or subsidizes training and skills in some way. And I think we've got a lot of work to do there. One of the positives from the pandemic is that particularly around the furlough scheme, there has been really good examples of this happening. You know, so the furlough scheme was designed really at really short notice at UK level by involving the CBI and the TUC. And, you know, it was then adapted to cover self-employed workers. So even at UK level, there has been a recognition that this is important in a crisis. At Scottish level, there was a real involvement of social partners in the pandemic process. So there is a sort of base of having demonstrated that it's important, and keeping that momentum, I think, is really important so that the benefits of building back better or sort of building and rebuilding various sectors of the economy are shared more evenly. It's very difficult to do that without some sort of social dialogue and collective bargaining. We know that collective bargaining is the single most effective way of sharing the benefits of that kind of growth and that kind of recovery. And so it would seem shame to kind of ignore the lessons that we've learned during pandemic about how effective social dialogue can be as we kind of recover and the economic and the social benefits start to pick up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just building on that, I mean, I assume from what you're saying is that there's potential lessons that could be taken to other areas, so beyond skills and training. And are there other examples around the world of where people do this better than us and where this is more potentially, and what are the outcomes that they get from that? We were chatting with Bat Van Ark as part of the other part of this podcast about productivity and what we can learn from other countries around the world that can do things in a different way to boost our productivity. Are there any lessons for this context?
Yeah, I think there are. And I think one of them is sometimes when I talk about this kind of thing, people assume it's a really political agenda because I tend to talk about trade unions and collective bargaining, which in this country are really associated with the left and perhaps the Labour Party, perhaps quite archetypally. But actually, I think what we forget when we think in UK terms is that actually in many of our competitor countries, these are just taken for granted norms of how you do business. So in Germany, for example, which is often used as an example, there are really structured forums at sector level, company level, occupational level to work out what terms and conditions of work look like, pay rates, hours, skills training, all sorts of areas of work and employment, which are just part of doing business in Germany. It's not a particularly controversial idea. So one of the things I'm quite interested in when we look at Scotland is because we're talking about a relatively small country in Scotland, some of our comparator countries like Denmark, for example, Netherlands, they really do have some well-established structures in these kinds of areas. They all look slightly different because the national setting varies. And of course, as soon as you talk about skills, you're often talking about that intersection with education. And so obviously the education systems are very different. But all of them have a sort of structure and an organization to these processes that we have really dismantled in the UK in the last 40, 50 years or so. One of the countries I think is really interesting, and we looked at in a report briefly that I did recently, was Singapore, because I don't think anyone would think of Singapore as a massively leftist country. And yet the structures of social dialogue in Singapore are really well established. And there's much more state involvement, as we might expect in Singapore. But there are really structured ways for organizations and workers' organizations and companies to come together to work out what skills training is one of their big focuses, and how the country can then position itself for the challenges of next 10 to 20 years. Because we're going to see a huge amount of change in work and employment in that time. Lots of new technologies being used, lots of new work patterns. That if they're not negotiated, there is a real risk of not taking workers with us as those things happen and creating a lot of fear and anxiety and real a lack of preparedness for what those challenges, for the challenges ahead in those kinds of areas.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say that. And it's really interesting to think about it like that, isn't it? It's actually about productivity and innovation in the workplace and potential long-term benefits that can come through. And just one of the things I've been struck just reading by your work and reading it in advance of the podcast today was that some of the work you've been doing has actually been with the Scottish Parliament and the SPICE, the Parliamentary Information Centre's Academic Engagement Programme. And I was just wondering if you could give some quick reflections about what you see the value in that. So obviously you're an internationally and well-respected academic, but why do you get involved in that kind of engagement with policymakers at that level? I mean, is that something which is strategically important for you in terms of your research and the ideas that you wanted to try and pursue?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's really important that, you know, I get the space as an academic to think about these things and to read about them and to go and talk to lots of people about how this works in lots of different countries and organisations and sectors. And I love doing all of that stuff. And no policymaker would ever have the chance to spend doing all of that stuff. And I enjoy that. And I like writing academic papers and those kinds of things. But I also think it's really important, for me at least, that some of that gets... I talk about that expertise with people who really need to understand it. So if you are designing a new skills policy or a change to apprenticeship policy or something like that, we as academics have a huge amount of information that we know, but also we know how we could get hold of if we don't already know. And engaging in those conversations about how we can then use that knowledge to make better policies, evaluate policies, for example, more effectively, work out where the barriers are and not have that kind of, because we don't have necessarily that politician's hat on. So we're not driven by those concerns. We have more time than policymakers normally do to reflect on these things. And so for me, that interface is really, really important. For me, it's never been about just sitting here thinking about these things and writing academic theory papers. It's always, my career has always been about trying to make work better for all of us. And the more people that I can explain things to, explain what we know, explain what we don't know, find out what we don't know if we don't know it, the better, as far as I'm concerned, because we've all, most of us end up spending an awful lot of time of our adult life at work. And a lot of people have really miserable experiences, and that's not good for any of us. So that for me is a big driver. And I'm really pleased that the Scottish Parliament Information Centre took on board my proposal. They have an annual call for engagement with academics. They work with about five or six academics a year around a set of projects, many of which are projects that they propose, but there's always an opportunity to kind of pitch ideas at them. And this project was in that category, so it wasn't one that they'd actively proposed. And then there's an opportunity to just work with them. And for me, also understanding better how the Scottish Parliament works. Sadly, this all happened during COVID, so I didn't actually get to go there very much. But that opportunity is still there. So I would really, anyone who wants to sort of engage with policymakers, particularly in Scotland, that fellowship scheme is well worth keeping an eye on. And then more generally, I do think that as a social scientist, I have a responsibility to promote the public value of social science. For me, that's really at the heart of why I do what I do. And for me, you know, particularly researching work and employment, which is something that most of us have some experience of, to me, there's nothing more important than that, or nearly nothing more important than that. It has so many social and economic effects that if we get that wrong, there are a lot of other bad stuff happens, and that's not a good place for anybody.
No, and that's fascinating and insights. And when you think about the context of where our economy is at the moment, post-pandemic, cost of living crisis, and productivity challenges, you know, this sort of work is really important. And I think doing it really closely with policymakers to make that change and make research better too, I think is really powerful. And it's been fascinating chatting with you, Mel. And yeah, we'll look to get you back on soon to chat about how this work is going. Perhaps maybe more stable economic times would be.
Hopefully.
Excellent. Good to speak to you, Mel.
Take care.